But drone swarms never proved to be efficient. If you can build drones complex enough to carry out combat ops, you might as well just make missiles. Far more effective for the same resources.
That assumes the drones are offensive,
Nolan said.
What if they're purely defensive?
Yeah, maybe. They'd do great at fleet defense against ship killers. Fortunately, we're not particularly reliant on missiles. The mutuality ships we've inherited use missiles as threats and bludgeons to try to break through so the ships can do the real work close in with beams and railguns. So do we have to worry about this ship? Tixban had been working at his sensors console all the while.
I'm detecting, or I should say, not detecting, a peculiar number of signals from the ship. That is, very few signals. It should be ablaze with electromagnetics, radio or laser comlinks to the drones, for example. But there's almost nothing. The drones are either completely automated, or they're piloted.
Are they big enough to be piloted?
Barely, but even the smallest sentient being, such as an opter dog bee, would seem a highly inefficient waste of mass. It's nonsensical.
Well, it must make some sense or the Huns wouldn't do it, snapped Engels. Keep trying to figure it out, and report to me when you have facts and answers, not just wild speculations.
In truth, wild speculations were running through her own head, too.
One fact, Nolan said a few moments later. Its armor is peculiarly thick, and its reinforcement and impeller emanations show it to be rich in power generation capacity. This ship can take a pounding like a monitor triple its size. And given its unusual maneuverability, it will be an extremely difficult target at range, even for Indomitable's particle beam.
Engels nodded, trying to integrate that into her analysis. What the hell could justify the evident investment in such an exotic ship? It probably absorbed the resources of 8 to 10 SDNs, super dreadnoughts the Huns therefore didn't build. They must think it was worth it.
Admiral?
Nolan seemed perplexed.
Yes. My apologies. This is too preliminary, forgive me. I must return to myself.
With that, Nolan hurried off the bridge.
Trinity!
Engels barked into the air.
What's going on? There is no cause for alarm, Admiral,
Indy's machine voice said.
However, we are conducting analysis that strains our computational limits. Please stand by.
For how long?
I estimate 1 hour, 40 minutes.
That's some deep thought.
It will take less time if I don't talk to you. Trinity out.
The voice fell silent. Engels growled under her breath.
Tixban, any idea what that's about?
No, only I suspect Trinity has detected something anomalous about the ship in question, but it must be of such an unusual nature that its meaning is difficult to divine.
In other words, you have no more idea than I do.
I believe I just said that, Admiral.
Engels stood.
Fine. Call me when you know something.
I do know one thing.
What's that?
Tixban zoomed in on the super ship, focusing on a smaller and smaller section of her hull until words were readable.
Victory. That's her name.
Good to know. I'm going to take a walk.
Red Wolf and 3 other Marines followed her as she stalked the corridors. Like Straker, she often thought better when she moved. But unlike him, she preferred to wander instead of pace. She waved and returned salutes when she came upon officers and crew, but her mind was on victory. The enemy would be soaking up reports from their own spy drones lurking around the Sparta system. They'd know about Indomitable from her bombardment of the enemy fortresses, but only her long-range capabilities in siege mode. They would be unsure of how she could fight against warships. And how would the enemy use their odd new ship? It might prove useful against a conventional fleet, but it would have no effect on Indomitable's powerful weaponry, which was the natural key to her own strategy. A fresh cup of caff and a sandwich later, Engels returned to the bridge. Nolan was still nowhere to be seen.
Trinity, report! Indy's disembodied voice spoke as the hologram dissolved and reformed.
I am still unsure of the facts, but I have some observations and preliminary findings.
Okay, granted, you're not sure. Get on with it, please. The hologram now showed Victory and a shell of drones around it. The fleet of small craft swirled and changed shape in sequence. A sphere, an ovoid, a tetrahedron, a dodecahedron, and so on.
You will notice the perfect coordination of the drones, Trinity said. Their movements are nothing like the opter drones, which follow organic flock principles like birds or fish. Instead of keying off their fellows, these are centrally controlled and nearly perfectly. Too perfectly.
How's that? Engels said. All they need is a sophisticated SAI to run their drones. They send commands to them all, and they execute. Doesn't seem so weird.
Tixban spoke up. Remember, Admiral, I have detected very few signals. Certainly not the many data links necessary to control the 512 drones we have observed.
More to the point, Trinity said with a hint of Zaxby-like testiness. There is no signal lag. Lightspeed is fast, but it is nevertheless finite. There should be a perceptible delay as EM signals propagate, yet there is not.
So they adjust their commands to take the delay into account, Engels said.
No,
replied Trinity.
Observe.
The hologram zoomed out to include a new spherical outer shell of escort ships, corvettes, frigates, destroyers. They also morphed and changed their formation, though much more ponderously. Yet they danced to the same tune as the drones, as if one mind bound and ruled them all with machine-like precision.
I have run a deep and thorough analysis, and can come to only one conclusion.
Tixban jumped into the pause. Faster than light communications.
Correct, Tixban, though blindingly obvious now that I've done the hard work.
I cannot be expected to compete with a three-part fused AI with alien quantum nanotechnology, Tixban said stiffly.
Then why even try?
Stop it, you two, Engels snapped. Act like officers, not like bickering children.
Aye, aye, ma'am, Tixban said.
I'm your special advisor, not an officer, Trinity said.
And as such, you'll do as I say or leave my fleet.
Engels stared upward, annoyed she had nothing on which to focus.
And by the way, Zaxby, you're still a new Earth and Republic officer, and didn't we commission Indy and Ensign?
I hereby reside, Zaxby's voice said.
As do I,
Indy's said.
I don't accept. You can both put your paperwork in through the proper channels when we return to a base.
We could just ignore you.
You want to be court-martialed?
Nolan's voice came next from the speakers.
Admiral, be reasonable. You don't have the power to compel our obedience.
I don't have the power to compel the lowliest Marine's obedience either, Engels said, standing and snarling. But I have the full authority of our Republic. You're either a citizen of that republic or not. You either take an oath to the Constitution, or you're no part of my command and my fleet. Trinity, you can't have it both ways, choosing when to follow my orders and when to flout them. You're either in or out.
She held her breath. She'd hate to lose Trinity, but she couldn't allow the AI to undermine her authority. Nothing but the sounds of the ship and the murmurs of the bridge crew passing orders and reports came for a long moment. Just when Engels thought Trinity had broken off the conversation, perhaps forever, Nolan's voice spoke.
You're right, Admiral. We must choose, and we choose to be in. We'll remain part of your command until and unless we process out through proper channels.
Engels let her breath out.
Good. But, Admiral, authority must match responsibility. We command a ship. I suggest we be jointly designated Commander Trinity by Field Commission.
Seems reasonable. I hereby commission you Commander Trinity.
She turned to an aide.
Draw up the proper documents.
Yes, ma'am.
I'll now administer your commissioning oath.
When that was done, Engels said in acid tones,
Great. Can we get back to business?
Over the next hours, Engels, Trinity, and the rest of her staff watched Victory as she cruised inward at the center of the home fleet, performing various maneuvers and exercises as she traveled. It became obvious that the vessel was the flagship. This clarified some of the murkiness surrounding Victory's function. With her FTL communications, fortunately limited to a few million kilometers, it seemed, she provided superb coordination to the capital ships around her. What's more, she seemed to have taken direct control of all the lighter vessels within that sphere.
I estimate this flagship Victory increases the effectiveness of their fleet by approximately 180%, said Trinity. Taking this into account, our two forces are now approximately equal in combat power, though highly asymmetrical in capabilities.
Engels stroked her chin.
I'm trying to figure out why they're demonstrating these capabilities to us. You're sure they're not faking anything? That this could be a deception program of some sort? I'm not sure. However, there have been glitches and errors, which are quickly corrected. Meaning what? I prefer not to speculate.
Zaxby loves to speculate. Let me talk to him, Engels said.
That's not how our mind works.
I don't give a crap how your mind works. Commander Trinity, I order you to speculate. Guess. A sigh proceeded from the bridge speakers, and Zaxby's voice continued.
My guess is they pressed Victory into service before her special trials were completed, and so they're using every moment to exercise her capabilities.
They're pretty confident to show it all to us.
That worries you.
Damn right it does, unless they're bluffing, trying to get inside my head.
To what purpose?
Good question. Try comlinking them. Maybe they'll talk.
They are too far away for a link. We can transmit a message. It will take them over an hour for a reply to reach us.
And all the while, we're coming closer and closer to battle, Engels mused. And if we're talking, how can we ambush them and not look like lying scum?
I thought the purpose of our presence here was to thrash them thoroughly.
Engels sighed.
That makes it sound like we'd be slapping around some thug. But what it really means is killing thousands of people and destroying ships, while the opters wait in the wings. I'd really hoped our win at Calypso would bring the Huns to the negotiating table. Any reasonable government should have at least started talking by now.
Then their government must be unreasonable.
Yes.
A chill went through Engels as an epiphany struck her. She'd grown up in the Hundred Worlds, and every show vid and news vid had portrayed the government as democratic, law-abiding, and reasonable. The war against the Hawk, actually the Mutuality, and now the Republic, was said to be defensive and justifiable. The Hawk were monsters that couldn't be bargained with. Yet, beginning with her capture, she'd found out that this was all a lie. The Mutuality was a bleak and twisted system, one that oppressed its own people with misery and brutal ideology. But it hadn't hidden the truth about its enemies. The Mutuality spewed propaganda, but at its root was a core of truth. The Huns wouldn't make peace before, and they wouldn't even talk now. But why? What was the harm in talking, especially since the Hundred Worlds elites knew the real situation, that the Hawk were merely soldiers, not murderous aliens? No, there had to be more to the story. Something was keeping the Hundred Worlds from even opening a dialogue. So was she going about this all wrong? Smashing the Huns once, twice if she counted the battle at Corinth over a year ago, hadn't convinced them to talk. Talking was rational, would preserve lives and wealth and military strength. She'd read history, even on old Earth when the nuclear-armed empires of the 20th century were locked in their struggle called the Cold War. They'd had embassies and diplomats. They hadn't nuked each other. They'd fought indirectly through proxies and insurgencies and terrorists. But then, there was World War II. the dictator in charge of the German Empire had refused all calls to surrender. He'd had to die before the war could be ended. That idea felt right to her. Somebody at the top, one person or a small cabal, must hold the real power, and they didn't want the war to end. In her political science classes at Academy, she remembered her professor saying that if you wanted to know why leaders did what they did, look at their true self-interests. So why would someone not want a hot war to end? Not a simmering border war, but a war that threatened the very centers of power. What kind of people would risk losing everything if they had the option to settle for peace with honor?
Look at their true self-interests.
What if her theoretical cabal actually had nothing to lose? This whole thing only made sense if those at the top thought they couldn't be personally ruined, if they wanted the bloody battles to go on, and if what they truly cared about was immune to harm, as if they were mere players of a game where the destruction of pieces didn't really matter.
Look at their true self-interests.
Her thoughts kept returning to the Opters and what Myrmidon had told Straker. A truce would end the bleeding and might eventually lead to a permanent settlement, even if humanity remained split between two empires and a scattering of independent systems. Peace would lead to strength and growth. Humanity was a pioneering species, constantly exploring, building, and expanding.
Look at their true self-interests.
This was her epiphany. By all the signs, it wasn't humans, real humans anyway, who were in control of the 100 worlds. It must be Opters. Even if they looked human, were human, physically, like Myrmidon. That made her wonder who among the former Mutuality and now the Republic were also Opter men. Benota claimed to have developed a biological test. But what if he were one of them? Or De Chang, or Ellen Gray, or hell, anyone at all? She remembered Karst and his sudden betrayal, something that had made little sense to her at the time. What if he was an Opter agent like Myrmidon, with a mandate to stir up trouble? If she died, would Straker still have succeeded in the liberation? Maybe not. There'd been so many near-run battles. Any failure might have derailed everything. Engels retired to the flag conference room, shut the door, and told Trinity to make sure they were secure from eavesdropping. Then she explained her thinking to the group mind.
Your theorizing seems sound, at least until you conclude the Opters are the culprits, said Trinity. There are other alien regimes on humanity's borders. None with the military power or the biological expertise of the Opters. None we know of, you mean. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. In fact, no military power is needed to subvert a regime, only some method of undetectable infiltration.
Engels growled.
We have to operate on a theory that fits the facts. My theory is it's Opters, but nothing changes if it's someone else. The point is, there's someone at the top who's keeping this war going by refusing all diplomacy. It's the only thing that makes sense. A supposedly sensible, wealthy, and democratic government, as the 100 Worlds claims to be, should have welcomed the new Earthen Republic with open arms, settled the war, and started negotiating trade deals to make them even richer than they are.
But how does this help us now? Said Trinity.
That stopped Engels short. She'd gotten so caught up in the big picture that she'd temporarily forgotten about the looming battle.
Makes me wonder if it's worth fighting. We could still retreat. We could bomb the mech suit factory, head back, and start retaking the systems we lost.
We might simply have to fight a decisive battle some other day, with fewer advantages.
Yes, but with more data on this weird flagship. Right now we're in uncharted waters.
will we ever have the numbers and preparation we do now. We are forcing them to fight to protect a valuable resource, which limits their options. And they know as little about Indomitable as we do about victory. All right. Keep talking. Tell me everything you've figured out. 2 hours of briefing later, Admiral Engels was feeling far more optimistic about this battle anyway. Call my commanders for a holo conference, she said. Make sure Warmail Dexon is invited first.
Chapter 22 Straker on Terra Nova. The water chilled Straker as he plunged into it and bobbed to the surface. In the last few moments before the wall, he breathed rapidly and deeply, oxygenating his bloodstream, trying not to think about Gorbin's final words to him. Rosalind carrying his child? Impossible. He hadn't made love with Rosalind, had he? Though there was that one night after the assassination attempt where he couldn't remember much of anything. Can't worry about that now, he thought. Survival came first. He should be good for at least 2 minutes underwater. He'd been practicing holding his breath for longer and longer periods ever since Gorbin had told him of the river exit. He went under the wall's edge. Immediately he reached up to brush his fingertips along the top of the tunnel, searching for an air bubble. But there was no gap. He turned on the hand light as the sun's glow faded behind him. Abruptly, he felt the river turn downward and speed up further as it narrowed. If he'd had breath, he'd have sworn a blue streak. Instead of passing quickly under the wall, the tunnel was turning into a pipe and plunging deep into the ground. The faster he got through it, the more likely he would reach an exit, or at least an air pocket. So he turned head downward and swam, yet conserved his strength. His lungs ached as the seconds ticked by. He began to despair when he suddenly found himself sailing through the air. He plunged into a pool and was driven downward by the falling water until he bumped a hard bottom. Kicking off concrete, he surfaced and took great lungs full of air. Straker found himself inside a dark reservoir, perhaps 100 meters long, 30 wide, and 10 deep. At one end, the river water poured in from a 2-meter pipe in the ceiling, the way he'd entered, and fell through the air before joining the pool. At the other, it flowed outward and down another tunnel. His light showed handholds in the concrete, and he swam quickly for them, before the current could send him farther. He'd been lucky enough to reach breathable air this time. He might not be so fortunate again. Once on the lip above the reservoir, he found a pressure door. Fortunately, it was unlocked and opened when he spun the dogging wheel. Beyond it lay a dark corridor. Putting aside all thoughts of Rosalind, he paused and shone his light left and right. Damp, cold air seemed to flow slowly from the right, so he turned that direction and walked, wet and chilled to the bone. Soon he heard voices using the high tongue, the click language. They spoke too rapidly and oddly for Straker to catch more than a simple word or two. Work and food and water was all he recognized. Straker turned off his light, loosened his fighting knife in its sheath, and walked slowly forward. He saw no light, so he kept his fingertips on the left wall. A smell like wet animal got stronger as he advanced, yet still no light appeared. The voices became louder until they seemed no more than 10 meters away, though the concrete walls made sound echo strangely. Accompanying the clicking language was a cacophony of intermittent but regular scraping noises and clicking sounds, as of scrap metal being tumbled in a barrel. Inching closer, he felt as if he could reach out and touch whoever was speaking, yet still he saw no light. No, wait. His eyes finally adjusted to the darkness, and he was able to perceive a faint greenish glow from beyond a sharp left-hand corner. When he peeked around the corner,
he saw a long chamber with steep, straight terraces like steps climbing the left and right walls. Parts of the room glowed with phosphorescent moss or lichen on the surfaces. He could see some of it close to him, where a trickle of water flowed on the floor and into a drain. The speakers, what looked like two men in fur coats, stood at the near end of the long room. Each carried something long and flexible in one hand. They watched idly as at least 20 other men scraped the lichen off the concrete with small tools, putting it into bags they wore in front of them. Now that Straker realized what they were doing, it became clear to him that the dark patches were areas that had already been scraped. The workers were harvesting a garden, then. No, not workers only. Prisoners, or slaves. Straker realized the true situation when one of the laborers climbed down from one level step to the next, dragging a chain with him. The chain linked his ankles to each other as well as to the next man on his left and right, giving him about a meter of play. One worker, who to Straker moved as if elderly, slipped on the slimy surface and fell two levels, dragging three others off their feet and sending tools and bags flying. A great wail went up from the other workers, and they scrambled to help their comrades up and gather their meager belongings, scrapers, bags, and the spilled lichen. In an instant, the casual conversation of the two guards vanished as they roared with anger. They used the flexible rods in their hands to unmercifully beat the man who'd fallen, as well as anyone near him. Every time one of the rods struck metal, such as the chains, sparks flashed. Clearly the rods were like stun goads, except they didn't knock the hapless slave out. They inflicted pain. Pain wands. The old man screamed and cried and gibbered with agony as the guards thrashed him. The others shrank away, terrified to try to help. Straker's blood boiled as he remembered mutuality thugs masquerading as prison guards. He sprang forward and clubbed the nearest abuser down with the pommel of his knife, and then the other, knocking them unconscious. He then seized a pain wand. Unfortunately, he grasped it too high on its length, and a spasm of hurt shot through his hand, making him drop it. He then picked it up gingerly by its grip and searched for a way to turn it off. He stepped back when one of the prisoners picked up the other pain wand and stood over the fallen guards as if to protect them. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" he asked the man. The prisoner made no reply, but only twitched his pain wand slowly in front of him, as if trying to warn Straker off. "You don't want me to hurt these guys? Screw that!" Straker's eyes narrowed. "Can you understand me? Can anyone?" Nobody answered. He tried his limited, high tongue. "Back! Away! Go!" He emphasized his words with a gesture of the pain wand. The man became agitated, slashing inexpertly in Straker's direction, not really trying to strike him.
"Boy, they got you guys brainwashed," he muttered in earthen.
"Sorry about this." Straker struck the other's pain wand aside with his own, and then slapped the man's wrist with its active end. The man dropped the wand with a howl and backed up. Straker retrieved the second wand.
"Okay, now that that's settled," he switched to high tongue. "Go! Back! Away!"
The prisoners seemed to understand, and all retreated with a rattle of chains. Straker searched the guards. As he'd thought, they wore long, thick fur coats over trousers and shirts. Underneath, they looked Earth-human. Over the coat, they wore harnesses with various useful gear attached, such as knives, scrapers, gloves, and pouches of what looked like square coins of pure copper or silver. He took one coat that fit him and drew it on, and then the harness with all its kit. Now he looked like a guard. When he approached the shrinking prisoners more closely, he found, to his shock and surprise, that they weren't wearing coats after all. Rather, they were covered in thick, oily fur similar to what he now wore. Only their faces and hands were naked, like apes. They must be another variation of the humanoid opters, like the brightly colored Caloria or the crimson Bortox. One, bolder than the rest, took a tool from the other guard's harness and unlocked his own ankle shackle. But when he tried to do it for the others, they cried out with fear and slapped at him, forcing him to desist in disgust. "Guess your friends don't want to be free," Straker said. "They're brainwashed." The man stared at him and spoke the clicking tongue. Straker caught only the word woman. Maybe he was saying they were acting like frightened women. Clearly, they'd never met Rosalind or Carla. Straker debated leaving the cowed prisoners in chains, but decided against it. Instead, he gestured for the one brave man to unlock his fellows and stood menacingly with his pain wands to ensure it got done. Soon, all were unchained. Some began eating the lichen, while others continued scraping and gathering. None of them ran off or appeared to want to escape. The single brave one shrugged, apparently a universal human gesture, and stuffed some of the lichen in his mouth. Straker tried it and found it tasteless. He ate some anyway and put more in his own bag in case he needed it later. Straker said his own name several times, patting his chest. The other man nodded and patted his own.
"You, Straker. I, Melgar."
Melgar. That's how it sounded to Straker as he repeated it. He handed a pain wand to Melgar, carefully, by the grip. Melgar gave the pommel a twist, and then, after donning the fallen guard's coat, boots, and harness, slung the device by its wrist strap. Straker did the same, happy to know how to turn the thing off.
"We go away. Hide," he said.
"Yes, come. Follow."
Melgar motioned Straker to accompany him, leading him through concrete ways dimly lit by a combination of the lichen and barely brighter glow strips on the ceiling. They passed several chambers where work parties gathered lichen or other plants. Some chambers had soil and sprouted mushrooms or fungus. In others, the plants looked conventional but were not green. Always the two men sneaked past bored, cruel guards overseeing downtrodden workers. Some work parties consisted of women with females in charge. Beatings seemed common. It appeared the standard humans were always the guards, and the furred humans were all prisoners. No, strike that, they were most likely slaves, if their status was based on their species, rather than being, say, convicted criminals. Straker lost track of the tunnels and rooms they saw. Melgar led him past dozens, and he had the impression there were hundreds more, a vast anthill of underground food production. They made sure not to approach too closely to others, and in the dimness they both looked like guards in uniform. At one point, they gazed down from a gallery upon a vast hall where thousands of chained workers processed the plants. The harvesters dumped their loads into bins, and the contents were sorted, dirt and rocks were discarded, and the resultant improved product was washed, cut, and packaged into reusable woven bags. The bags were then brought to a separate area to be sold for the square coinage. The people who bought the produce appeared to be of a different sort than either the furred ones or the standard humans. These were distinctly insectoid, but bipedal, with large compound eyes and feathery antennae. To Straker, they gave the impression of upright ants with only four limbs, two arms, two legs. Maybe they were early versions of opter men, before they were genetically engineered into their many current varieties. Among them, Straker noticed a human figure. At first, he thought it was Myrmidon again, but it wasn't. Yet the man seemed similar in his demeanor, his movements, as he circulated among the customers. Another agent? The man glanced up at Straker, and their eyes locked for a long moment before he turned and left the buying floor, pushing his way past the insectoids. It seemed he was uncomfortable to be observed. Could he be one of Myrmidon's spies, or just another agent in training? Straker and Melgar moved on. Another large hall appeared to be a slave hospital, at least at first. Straker saw crude beds with the furred people lying on them, ankles chained to their beds. Some simply lay sleeping, but some sat up and tried to get the attention of attendants. One vigorous one, after wolfing down food in a bowl, complained loudly enough that he was led away.
"Work. More work," Melgar said. "Alive. Work, worker."
Worker. Straker racked his brain for a word. Worker strong. Work again?
Yes. Want work again.
So, in this hospital, the slaves asked to be sent back to work. That made him wonder what the alternative was. It wasn't long before he found out. Two doctors entered and began examining the patients in turn with stethoscopes and other instruments, taking pulses, looking at teeth with all the clinical care of veterinarians. The healthiest they ordered marched out on their feet. The sickest, especially those who seemed unresponsive, they pointed out to a troop of orderlies. The orderlies took these out on stretchers, while the rest of the patients watched dully. Melgar pulled on Straker's arm and led him via the gallery tunnel to the next room. The orderlies rolled the dead or dying slaves roughly onto tilted stone slabs and quickly hurried away. Other workers in aprons and cloth masks then positioned the bodies head down on the slabs and without hesitation cut their throats. Blood gushed down runnels into buckets. One poor live soul jerked and struggled until the butcher grabbed a mallet and struck him on the forehead. Straker felt queasy and outraged. He'd seen plenty of death on the battlefield, but this was treating people like meat animals. Even the mutuality prison was more humane than this. Once the corpses were drained of blood, the butchers used cleavers to hack off the heads of the dead. Straker didn't think he could be more horrified until he saw what came next. The butchers used sharp knives to expertly skin and dress the corpses. They treated the human fur pelts with care, removing them in contiguous pieces and passing them to helpers who carried them out of the room, presumably for further processing. The carcasses were then hung and carved up into various cuts of meat. A wave of nausea swept Straker's guts, and he barely kept himself from retching. He turned to Melgar and saw the man's face was filled with grief and rage, his fingers white as he gripped the stone rail. Slowly, Straker reached across to grasp his new partner's shoulder in firm, comradely sympathy. Melgar turned to Straker and returned the gesture, hand to shoulder.
"You see, Straker, bad, enemy, bad."
He used other words, but they were unfamiliar.
"I got it, friend," he said in Earthen. "To them, you're nothing but animals."
He switched to the click tongue.
"Melgar, friend, I see. Bad."
Then, when Straker thought things couldn't get worse, the plush sensation under his hand penetrated his consciousness. He looked, then touched Melgar's furred neck above his collar. Then he jerked his hand off his friend's pelt and ran it along the coat he wore. They matched. Solemnly, Melgar nodded.
You see.
Unknowable creator, what the fuck?
Straker began frantically unbuckling the harness and unfastening the smooth ivory buttons of the coat.
Gods and demons, I'm wearing human skin.
No, no, Straker, no.
Melgar hissed, trying to get Straker to stop.
Yes, no, Straker, friend. Stop, I know. I know. Bad, you must stop. Hide, run. Not know. I forgive. I forgive.
He accompanied these simple words with gestures designed to show Straker that Melgar didn't hold it against him, the fact he was wearing human fur. Straker stopped trying to strip off the garment, but now he felt as if he were contaminated. He took deep breaths and told himself to get a grip. The poor guy whose skin he wore wouldn't be helped by freaking out. He'd just have to deal with it. He made himself think about returning to Carla, about his responsibilities to his friends and the Breakers, and about his time in the prison camp. He'd survived getting shit poured onto him, flies laying eggs in his wounds, daily torture. By comparison, this was a piece of cake. But he resolved once more never to be taken. Instead, he crammed all his emotions into a mental box, locked it, and threw away the key. Cold outside, that was the way to be. Do what needed to be done now, and only allow himself to feel later.
Okay, Melgar. I'm good. What now?
Despite those words being spoken in Earthen, or the low tongue, as the Kalareans called it, Melgar seemed to understand.
We go. Look, my woman.
He led Straker onward. After more purposeful skulking, Straker was considering trying to insist Melgar show him a way to the surface, when they reached another gallery above a factory floor where the slaves produced various liquids, boiling them, mashing substances and mixing them in, sending them through pipes to cool and drip, filling small barrels or kegs. Many guards watched the process, more than with the food, as if these fluids were more valuable. In fact, there were two guards on overwatch at the other end of the gallery with Straker and Melgar, but for now they paid the two men no attention.
Of course they must think we're their comrades, thought Straker.
He noticed Melgar turned his fur-framed face away. As with the foods, at the end of the room was a sales and tasting area where buyers sipped from tiny flutes they provided themselves. This time, though, the customers were short and chubby, with bald, round heads and flat, stubby noses. They sported fine clothing in a modern style, trousers, shirts, tailored jackets, and wore platform shoes to make themselves taller. They bore wristwatches and tapped at what looked like hand tabs. Some of them also wore human fur. Straker mentally labeled them pig people. A thrill shot through Straker. The pig people were obviously from the surface. They must be either controllers or from a diz with higher technology. That made them, and whatever route they took to come shopping for their handcrafted beverages, his ticket out of here. He looked, but spotted no agents. At his elbow, Melgar spoke rapidly and pointed at a woman in chains who was stirring a huge pot full of boiling liquid.
My woman. Take, run, hide.
Hell, Straker said in Earthen. How are we supposed to get through all those guards?
Melgar seemed to understand. Maybe he knew more low tongue than he let on. He rummaged in his harness pouches until he pulled out a roll of bandage. He used his knife to lightly stab the heel of his hand and bleed on the gauze, and then made motions until Straker understood. Straker helped wind the bloody bandage around Melgar's whole head, neck, and face, concealing the fact that he was a furred man. Now, A casual onlooker would only see a wounded guard in a fur coat. Once that was done, Melgar moved purposefully for the stairs down from the gallery.
"Here goes nothing,"
Straker muttered as he followed. Chapter 23 Engels, Sparta System. The magnificent Hundred Worlds home fleet approached Sparta III, confident of victory. They should believe they faced only Indomitable and a collection of about 100 ships, proportionally distributed from SDNs down to corvettes. But Engels had used the time to equip many of her ships with the Trinity-designed deception emitters, which could make corvettes seem like dreadnoughts, or vice versa. They wouldn't fool optical sensors, but other measures could. For example, each of her non-hiding ships aimed wide-beam laser flashes directly at the enemy fleet and any known scout ships. These would act as spotlights in the enemy's eyes, making it hard for them to get clear readings. Many of her ships were also concealed behind asteroids, moons, and the planet itself. Some had even set down on the surface of planetoids and gone entirely MCON. All the while, small craft with even more emitters had scurried this way and that in order to confuse the enemy. But Engels worried about the flagship Victory. Its actions and configuration showed it to be an AI-controlled ship, according to Trinity. That meant the Huns had somehow cracked the AI madness problem, at least temporarily. It was still possible that the Victory AI would eventually lose its mind, but even if it had to be rebooted before every battle, it would do its job. If it were an AI, it might be able to analyze its way through her deception measures. Yet, she had to act as if her plan would work. On the other hand, no battle plan survives contact with the enemy, she reminded herself. The home fleet came on in perfect spherical array, utterly confident. Each ship had perfect lines of sight and was optimally placed with mathematical precision. No doubt they could be reconfigured with exceptional efficiency. But Engels remembered a quote from Professor Pournelle's classes on tactics at Academy. The retired admiral had said, "Don't mistake efficiency for effectiveness. They aren't the same. The most efficient commander may still lose a battle to one who knows how to be effective. The effective commander must be willing to profligate with his or her forces, if that is the price of victory." She wondered whether this AI would understand that, and whether it was running the battle itself, or only managing it under orders from Admiral Niedern. She decided, from what she knew of Niedern, that the Admiral wouldn't give the Victory AI total control. It wasn't in his nature. Therefore, her deception plans, her mind games aimed at this man, should still work.
"Trinity, is the FTL data link bubble shrinking as you expected?" Engels asked.
"It is."
"Then their new system does use side space for transmission, even within curved space."
"Correct. But the deeper into curved space they come, the shorter its range appears to be. By the time battle is joined, it should be less than 100,000 kilometers in radius."
Engels grunted in satisfaction.
"That helps. Anyone outside that will have conventional command and control."
Tixban spoke.
"They are approaching Indomitable's firing range."
"All right. Here we go with our opening gambit. Helm, unmask."
"Aye, aye, ma'am."
The battleship slipped sideways on impellers, coming out of hiding behind Sparta's moon, Leonidas.
"Fire," said Engels.
From over 10 million kilometers distance, Indomitable's massive particle beam projector fired a bolt of near-light-speed destruction. Her intended target was Victory. If she got lucky, she might eliminate the flagship with one shot. If not, Engels's fleet would gain valuable intelligence on how the enemy would handle the bombardment. The shot took over 30 seconds to reach the Hun fleet, and an equal amount of time for sensor pulses to return to show the results. When they did, the entire bridge crew let out a low groan. The hollow plot of the enormous beam knifed through the enemy fleet, but seconds before the shot had struck, the ships had begun complex, evasive maneuvers. Each Hun vessel dodged obliquely to the limits of their individual capabilities, and all had moved away from the flagship. The beam vaporized one drone, it appeared, but nothing else.
"They spotted us unmasking and anticipated our shot," Engels growled.
"So it appears," said Tixpan. "The likelihood of hitting anything at this range is very small."
"When can we expect hits?"
"Hit probability against conventional targets approaches 50% at under 1 million kilometers.
"And against these ships?"
"I can only guess how much advantage the AI's ability to evade gives them."
"Trinity,"
the AI meld replied,
"I will refine my analyses as we go, but I suggest planning for half that range."
Engels examined her fleet deployment in the hologram. 100 ships, all heavy cruisers or battle cruisers, stood off near Leonidas, arrayed as if to fight head-on. Their emitters should make them look like a whole fleet of various ships. Hopefully, the enemy would believe this was her core force and assess it to be no match.
"Are they velocity committed yet?" Engels asked.
"As I already briefed you, Admiral, not for another 25 minutes, said Tixpan.
"Fine, fine."
At that time, the enemy would not be able to reverse and run. They would, however, be able to turn sharply away and bypass the planet if they wished. That would be a disaster for Engels, though. Her trap would only work if Nedern were overconfident enough to enter it so deeply he couldn't extricate himself. The minutes passed as Engels bit her nails. The murmur of clipped bridge conversation provided a familiar backdrop, but she detected nothing more than the usual nervousness before battle.
"They are soft launching," Tixpan said, but she could see that for herself.
The enemy ships dumped a wave of missiles that accelerated slowly ahead of the enemy, forming a screen. The weapons would be of various types: ship killers, bomb-pumped beams, decoys, anti-missile clusters. But all would appear the same until they activated or attacked.
"How many?"
2,400, approximately.
"Not a full fleet strike, then. Think we can handle that?"
"If we follow your plan, Admiral."
"Then we follow the plan."
Engels lifted her eyes to the hologram. The enemy's course took them near Leonidas, as she'd expected. The moon, Indomitable, peeked out from. Leonidas had no functioning weapons emplacements left. They'd either been bombarded by her ships or had been sabotaged before surrendering. But standard doctrine would dictate Nedern would want to clear it of lurking enemy before moving on to the planet itself. In fact, she depended on that adherence to doctrine. She glanced at the 16 icons representing ships on the back surface of Leonidas, the inner side facing the planet. Warmail, Commodore, Dexon, commanded these ships from his own, the Revenge. They were all Ruxin crewed archers, equipped with underspace generators and appropriate weapons. All were small and unarmored, fragile except for their ability to slip down into that strange, cold dimension and attack from hiding. All had their underspace generators powered down and were also in MCON. Republic relay drones beamed full data to them in real time, though, ensuring their computers had the latest information on the enemy. As soon as they inserted into underspace, they would have to rely on that data and the intuition of their captains in order to fight blind. Either that, or risk brief emergence for sensor updates. The problem was the time of surprising the enemy with archers was past, especially in a fleet battle. Engels had to expect plenty of detectors, which would pinpoint the underspace points of congruence and direct fusion weapons against them. There could be enough bleed over from the blasts to damage or destroy the fragile ships. There was one way to mask an archer's signature in underspace, though, and Dexon was poised to use it. It was an integral part of Engels's plan.
"Trinity, you're wired in and comfortable?"
"Of course, Admiral. You already asked me that."
"Sorry."
Engels had authorized Trinity to be taken aboard Indomitable and so be placed inside thick armor and to run the battleship's defensive systems. Engels had proposed turning over all targeting and firing to the group mind, but Trinity declined.
"While we accept the need for offensive action," Trinity said, "we would prefer not to control it."
Engels had shrugged at this rationalization. Each person, whether organic or machine, had an individual right to decide their own moral limits. Trinity, now explicitly under her command, would most likely have taken offensive control if ordered, but constantly pushing subordinates to do things they disagreed with would eventually backfire. People had to believe in the rightness of their actions, or at least in their necessity as the lesser of evils.
"Approaching velocity commitment," Tixpan said. "One minute."
"Give it the full minute, and then pass the order," Engels said.
1 minute later, the recorded order went out to all her ships to initiate the plan. First, her approximately 200 ships hiding or lurking on the enemy's flanks began to move and assemble at high speed. Perhaps 50 of these, her heaviest ships, had been in plain sight, but out of direct fire weapons range and far enough from the Hun's approach path, they would be ignored. Ignored, that is, because they all were disguised as escort-class ships. The Huns would have dismissed them as serious threats to their main fleet, and at the same time, seeing them had ensured the enemy didn't feel comfortable sending scouts out too far. Now, though, they dropped their masking emitters and turned on their active sensors, revealing themselves as battle cruisers, DNs, and SDNs. Then, another 150 true escort ships from corvettes up through light cruisers broke cover and dropped MCON, activating emitters that made them appear as heavier ships. As soon as the EM emissions reached their sensors and until they could get better readings and determine the truth, the enemy would be seeing about 200 capital ships converging on them from all directions, especially from the rear. Long seconds went by as various wavelengths crisscrossed the developing battle space. It took time to detect new contacts, more time to make decisions, and then even more time for opponents to assess enemy actions and reactions. The admirals and captains involved had to continually keep the time lag in mind as they gave their orders. The Hundred Worlds fleet reacted approximately as Engels expected and hoped. They increased acceleration moderately but not excessively. If they traveled too fast, they wouldn't be able to clear Leonidas of hostiles, nor remain in the vicinity of the prize, the planet of Sparta III itself. Speeding up too much might be a net positive for defending the fleet itself, but would force it to fly past and spend hours or days traveling a broad slingshot curve to come back. Either that, or turning their sterns to Indomitable and her cruisers in a brutal bid to decelerate into orbit. If they did so, they would present their open-engine exhausts to their enemies. The unarmored and relatively delicate fusion plenums would be subject to attack by every weapon imaginable, even the tiniest railgun submunitions. This would be like trying to walk ass backward into a gunfight, and just as self-defeating. With so much velocity and so many enemies behind them and Indomitable in front of them, a ship they very much wanted to destroy, the Huns would take the obvious best course. Beat the ships in front of them, battleship and all, secure the planet and its residual defenses, protect the mech suit factory, and then fight the Republic's pursuit wave. Therefore, they came on at optimal and predictable speed. All of Engel's maneuvering was designed to tempt the enemy into fighting on her terms, while making it appear as if they were fighting on their own terms. The tactics of mistake, another of her academy professors had called it.
"They have to know our converging ships aren't all capital ships, even if only by simple logic," said Tixpan. "They have likely detected the emitters, even if they cannot break the deception measures."
"It doesn't matter," said Engels. "Now that they're committed to this course, turning hard will present their sterns to too much fire.
As far as they know, they have at least a 2-to-1 advantage against what's in front of them, so that's where they'll go. Their advantage is speed and concentrated firepower, so they'll try to punch through, seize orbital space, and reactivate the fortresses, all the while slingshotting around Sparta as an irresistible